Talk given Sunday, 2nd March 1975. Let us first recall something which the Buddha used to say to his monks after having given a discourse. He said, "Here are trees. Here are the roots of trees. Sit, monks, and meditate. Meditate carefully, so that you give yourselves no cause for remorse afterwards, that you lost your opportunity when you had it." The same opportunity never occurs again. Similar opportunities do. Sometimes, not always. But the same opportunity never recurs again. And it is not unusual in the lives of human beings that the most significant or some of the most significant opportunities are missed by us, because we are insufficiently sensitive to the atmosphere around us, to the situation. We do not know that this is the great moment. Here is the tide, and if one embarks on that tide, most valuable will be the consequence of it. Today, therefore, let us be particularly attentive. I would like to consider together with you one of the extremely serious problems which besets the efforts of those who wish sincerely to live the religious life, especially in connection with this great question of mindfulness. In recent meetings, we have considered love and the Brahma Vihara, the divine abidings. To recapitulate very briefly, when someone came to the Buddha and asked him to show the way to union with Brahma, the Father God, the creator of the world, the Buddha gave out this teaching of the divine abidings, the Brahma Vihara, the residence, the dwelling in Brahma. Also, the Buddha gave out that teaching as part of the regular religious discipline of the monks themselves. Because unless the Brahma Vihara, these divine abidings, are fully realized, the true fulfillment of the religious life remains unrealized. Wisdom is one aspect, and love is the other aspect of this, of the wholeness of this realization. Hence its great importance. We have gone into this during the last two or three meetings, and we have also considered in some depth the great problem of living the religious life practically, and particularly putting into practice the ethics of religious living in our worldly milieu. The world of duality, of confusion, conflict, violence, greed, and utter stupidity presents the worst possible, the most difficult possible milieu for living the religious life. And we must always bear in mind that the religious life is not a particular restricted, limited life separate from the daily life from moment to moment. Now the world makes it extremely difficult to live religiously. And let us remember the true meaning of religious living. It is human living, not subhuman living. This is the important point. Mankind on the whole still lives bestially after 3 or 4 million years of development, as we call it, on the globe. Mankind as a whole has not begun to understand the true meaning of the word human. And as you all know by now, human means the one in whom all evil-mindedness is burnt out. The fundamental meaning of the word human in the religious context. So now, mankind as such is composed of individuals who are still in the subhuman state. And the purpose and the effects of the discipline of the religious life brings about the complete transformation of the subhuman into the human. This is the first point we must carefully bear in mind. The transformation of our subhuman state into the human state. And the next point in association with this is the fact that the essential sign, the hallmark of the transformation into the human state is the complete transformation of our mode of awareness of existence. I'll repeat that. The complete transformation of our mode of awareness of existence. Now, in the ordinary way, when we try to live the religious life in the world and apply the transcendental ethic of religious living in the situation in which we find ourselves in the world, we are in conflict with the world. We are against the world. It is true that the world is against us. And the world is the world, and all worldliness and all worldlings will always be against us. It is necessary that this should be the case. Because if that were not the case, there would not be the necessary challenge and the immense stimulus to call forth out of our being the fruition of transcendence itself. Therefore, the evil and the horror and the terror, the cruelty, the violence and everything of the world is a necessity for you, for me, for every one of us who's seriously concerned with the religious life. Consider very carefully how, when we turn to religion, we turn to it for comfort, for making our life easy, our life come to fruition according to our concepts of the true and the good and the beautiful and so on. Don't you see? All our concepts are misconcepts of reality. I don't mean reality as the person caught up in duality and functioning ambivalently would define reality, but the reality. See? Now, we have to wake up out of this wanting for ourselves, the very things that produces this world which is in such an evil pass. But we, in our way, trying to be gentle, to be pleasant and so forth, want precisely those same things on a different plane. That is all. We don't indulge in drink, say, but we indulge in something else. Always going to concerts. Always going to plays which are marvelous plays. Beauty, art, culture. These are the baits which make us indulge in them. The indulgence in them is a very different thing from right experiencing of them. You know Shakespeare's, "The surfeit of the sweetest things, the deepest loathing to the stomach brings," ultimately. So we indulge that way, in the name of superiority, refinement, and so on. So we are caught up in this illusion that we are trying to live the religious life. That we are trying to live by the law of love, when in actual fact we are mourning over that which we cannot grasp, that which is no longer ours, that which is lost, and so forth and so forth. And so the elements of self-pity and so on interfere with the reality of love. Where there is the reality of love, there is none of the sorrow which is born of grasping. there is the sorrow which is born of compassion for suffering all around, which is a very different thing. Now, why is it that we are in this state? Our mode of awareness has not undergone any sort of transformation. We are aware, we are conscious of existence in the same old way. Now, what is this same old way? You have heard me say it so often, ad nauseam almost. But don't be impatient, please. Be very patient. Work with me as we go along. And really see into this. We are aware of existence in terms of the fundamental duality of the self and the not-self. And the self and the not-self are not in harmonious interaction with each other, but in disharmony with each other. The not-self seeks everything it can get out of us, the way other people behave and act towards us and so forth, involves all that. We act precisely in the same way in relation to the not-self. We try to get everything that we want, that we can squeeze out of the not-self. In some form or other, it may be a gross and an obviously disgusting form, or it may be any one of the wonderfully refined forms, clothed under the name of the service of God, loving mankind, giving yourself to help this person, this society, and all the rest of it. But in our own inner consciousness, there is this permanent distinction between self and not self. And as long as that permanent distinction between self and not self is there, the forces that go out of us, radiate out of us, are always forces which tend to produce conflict, destruction, and the perpetuation of the ill state. Now note very carefully, I am not talking philosophically about self and not self and the conflict therein. I am talking about this in the context of our mode of awareness. How we actually are conscious of existence. Not how we think we are conscious or how we think we ought to be conscious of our existence. Now do you get it? It's nothing to do with that. It's with the actual fact. Of being actually conscious of existence in this way which spells ill. Because if we were not conscious that way, but we were aware of existence in the mode of immortality, of humanity, then there is no problem at all. It is because we are conscious this way that there is a problem. And apparently an insuperable problem. Now, theoretically, in words that is to say, we know that the key to the whole of the religious discipline lies in that word mindfulness, watchfulness in Christian terms, attentiveness, paying complete attention, as Krishnamurti always says. Whichever word you use, what is referred to is the same thing. Now let us look at the manner in which we try to exercise mindfulness. And also let us look into who is exercising mindfulness. Meaning by that, what sort of a person am I who is exercising mindfulness or trying to exercise mindfulness? What happens, for instance, when I say that I see something or somebody? In actual physical terms, scientific terms, you know all about that. Rays of light reflected from the thing or the person enter my retina and create a big flashing in the brain, in the roof brain as we call it, make impressions there at the back of the brain. And then I say, oh, I see so and so. But when I say I see so-and-so, am I actually seeing so-and-so, or am I seeing an image of him which has been created in my brain? Am I not looking at the image in actual fact? I am looking at my particular mental construct of that person. Now, what is the nature of this mental construct? Is it really true to him? Even as a pure picture of what he looks like, a photographic picture, we'll say, of what he looks like. Are you and I capable of true sight? I doubt it. If we were capable of true sight, we saw a person or a thing exactly as it is, how is it that our descriptions will all be different? They will bear certain resemblances, the descriptions. All of us here, if we see a human face, will not say that we are looking at an aeroplane. We'll say we are looking at a man's face. But now, having got that much sort of common ground, let us go further. How is it that none of us can give the same description as another person? We miss out something, we add something, we differ in our judgments as to what is actually there. The color of the skin, the light in the eyes, the shape of the hair, or does hair have shape, or whatever it is, you see, and so forth. They're all different, aren't they? So, we are not seeing truly. Now, come to the other aspect. The psychical aspect. We get an impression from that face. We interpret that face in terms of qualities. A kind face, a cruel face, an ugly face, a funny face, and so on. And all our interpretations are again different. Otherwise, all the girls would love the one boy totally, or all the boys would love the same girl totally. But they're all different. We care for this one, we don't care for that one. Why these reactions of attraction or aversion? You see what is happening. I'm looking at a person, and all this peculiar mental construct is formed in my mind with its associated psychological consequences. Then I say, I like, I don't like. I think I'll keep away, I'd like to cultivate that person. And so forth and so forth. And so the roots of craving, violence and so everything are present there, and we have the ill state and no true relationship. Now why does that happen? Now turn to ourself. I myself have an image of myself. I don't know myself. I think I do. I see all sorts of things. I wouldn't dream of acting that way. I'm a kind fellow. I'm a decent fellow. I'm a little bit of a rogue, etc. I gamble, but that doesn't matter. And, you know, the whole mass of confusion and nonsense. Tinsel in nonsense. Now, this is the person who has these strange criteria, standards, judgments, evaluations, which are all brought to play upon the simple phenomenon of looking. So you see, both ends of the situation are distorted ends. They are sick, both of them. The self and the impression of the not self upon the self. Now, have you ever tried to look deeply into the nature of your mindfulness when you practice mindfulness? First and foremost, we practice mindfulness purposively. We have a purpose. What is that purpose? To bring about some good, we say. But look carefully. That purpose, or the various purposes associated with it, are all self-oriented. They are for my good, my progress, my benefit, my liberation, my realizing nirvana, my being free in the world of the things that worry me, hurt me, and so forth, and of gaining the things which I like. Let's have no illusions about it. This selfness in us is a terrific power. It is a most subtle thing, the way it works. Now, all my interpretations of the not-self and all my interpretations of what's going on inside myself are all vitiated by this which is me, and which I imagine is me, my mental construct of me. And this mental construct is the product of that root source of ill, the division in my own consciousness between self and not self. Therefore, I am in the sinful state, to use a Christian term. I am in the ill state, to use the Buddhist term. We are told, we sincerely believe, and it is true, actually, that the key to this is this intense attentiveness, this intense mindfulness. And yet, we practice mindfulness with the utmost intensity we have, and the result is confusion. I'm getting no further. Have you noticed how the most egoistic egos, the most intensely self-asserting people, are very often, unhappily all too often, the positively religious-minded people, those with a religious drive, because they are doing things in the name of God, of the supreme good, and they have identified their own ego with God. This is the trouble. What produces a Torquemada? That sort of so-called religiousness, that religious fanaticism. What produces the one who sets up and runs concentration camps? And upholds an ideology, a political or economic or whatever ideology it is. The religious-minded person, that is a form of religion. These people have become so blind, so devilish, that they have cast away even the semblance of real religion and set up in its place this self, this awful self, and all that it thinks and believes in and wants to achieve as religion. All the totalitarians are fanatical people in the same sense as the religious fanatics. They are militants. They are destroyers. They cannot love. They have no wisdom, no truth in them. So you see, this attentiveness is vitiated all along the line. How are we to deal with this vitiation of our attentiveness, this ill attentiveness? This is the point. The attentiveness which is self-oriented and self-centered has to become completely unself-oriented, unself-centered. It has to have no center at all. When the center vanishes, the circumference, the sphere around the center, which marks the limit, the finite, and therefore mortality and pain and suffering and all the rest of it, that also vanishes. Now, how is the attentiveness to become this kind of attentiveness? You can't consciously set up a method for it, a technique for transforming the attentiveness in this manner, into this kind of transcendent attentiveness. There is no method. Now, this is the difficult point to grasp. But here is the real key. This is the heart of the matter. The attentiveness has to become, to stay as it is at the moment, the ill state, the self-oriented attentiveness, the self-concerned attentiveness, which perpetually separates me from the not me, and let it become intenser and intenser till it glows with a white heat. This is the important thing. Till it glows with a white heat. You know that wonderful word tapas in Sanskrit, which is translated as austerity, as watchfulness, as heat. Tapas in the modern languages of India simply means examination, to look at, to see what it is. Tapas, you see. But this essential meaning of heat, it hots up. You know how the Tibetans talk of tummo. Now, when this attention just hots up and hots up and hots up, what happens to attentiveness itself? In this hotting up, all that is dross, all that is evil in it gets burnt out by itself, by its own heat. You must really get hold of this is the central key point of the whole thing. This intensification of attentiveness. And when this white-hot attentiveness remains at that white-hot pitch, all the evil inside it is burnt up, but not cast aside. The dross is not separated from the gold. The dross itself is converted into the gold. Look, when you become capable of this kind of intense attentiveness, the hate power within yourself gets transformed into true love power. It will never again harm another or yourself. The greed power will be transformed into a completely liberating power, because it will make you totally unresisting, and therefore you will be a conduit through which transcendence will flow in and out quite freely. All your greed is transformed into that. And all one's stupidity becomes the wisdom that has gone beyond. You can't talk about it. Because no one knows it No one can know it in our ordinary dictionary meaning of the word know. This is the magic of transcendence. This is the divine power at work. All these wonderful phrases we have in the religious texts are, oh, we are so ignorant of them all. We are in such darkness. But it is this attentiveness which has to glow with this tremendous white heat, and the conversion from within takes place. Because of the intensity. Now, when that intensity is at work, your whole being is totally free of all desire, all fear. It is totally free of any sort of objective, any sort of goal. It happens that way. Eternal God, or call it what you like, the unborn, the unmade, the unbecome, use any phrases you like, is at work freely without me, I, obstructing it. Then, when I see anything, it is no longer related to a me, to my mental construct of me, and therefore despoiled of its reality, the truth of its being. Then these very eyes will see like the eyes of omniscience itself. You will see the truth as the truth, the fact, simply because there is no me to which it is related. If it is unrelated to the me, there is no limiting center nor confining circumference to hold it in. It is transcendent, it is divine, it is perfect as it will ever be for human beings, so long as they are constituted as they are. Then, when you look at a face, look at a piano, look at a cloud, at the twinkling of a star, you will see all these not only as you and I in our ordinary mortal state see them, but your immortal eye, the third eye, will also be open at the same time. And what you see will be both what your neighbor, an ordinary mortal, sees, as well as what an angel in heaven will see. You have to experience this. Don't seek the experience. It will never come if you seek it. It comes into being by grace of being. And the grace of being functions unhindered if you are unresisting. That is, if there is no interfering, isolating self-consciousness. You can never search out in your life. You may live for 1,000 years, 10,000 years. You can never search out in your own being all the obstructions to truth, to reality, to fulfillment. There are too many. The moment you've caught one devil, you see, another one slips out of your hand. And then he comes and attacks you. He jumps behind you. And his demoniacal laughter goes down the alleyways of all your memory and your efforts and so forth, mocking you. So don't do it that way. This white heat of intensity of attentiveness, Similarly, when you hear, when you listen, you are hearing my words now. Don't treasure up the words. Don't treasure up the meanings of these words as you see them at this moment of experiencing the words. But let your heart and your mind listen to the silence of the eternal reality through the medium of the words. Drop the words and their meanings out of your mind. Don't try to do it consciously. They will be there. Get the impress of it, and your own psyche will become more and more purified, and your mind freed of all its images, its concepts, its preconceptions, its assumptions, all its limitations, empty of all ill, will be able to open out to the total reality in complete fulfillment. So, it is this kind of attentiveness, this white heat of attentiveness, when it is the real white heat of attentiveness, it will be effortless. You don't have to strive for it. In the very early stages of the religious disciplines, when we try to learn to attend to something, we are taught to bring back the mind to the subject of attention if it wanders away. Yes, those are all the kindergarten stages. They have their own special value, but they are not the powers which transform your mode of awareness of existence, which is in the ill state of the mode of mortality into the transcendent state of the mode of immortality. When that kind of attentiveness functions through you quite spontaneously, naturally, and freely, you are everlastingly in the kingdom of heaven. Nirvana is here. In terms of mind and consciousness, the utter purification has taken place. The utter perfection is there. And it is that mind and consciousness which will interact with the world of its own accord, without desiring anything, without making any shapes as to what the world ought to be, and so forth. Therefore, you will never impose any ideas upon the world. You will be free of this childishness of evangelism. Now, as and when such attentiveness becomes natural, spontaneous, what happens to these problems with which we started? Don't think for a moment that that part of the problem which is inevitably and inextricably associated with the world as such will no longer assail you. Of course it will. But look at the difference. In my worldly state, in my ill state, I approach and interact with the problem at the level of illness, of evil, and therefore with the techniques which produce evil. The same techniques. I'm just as much an evildoer as this world which I call evil. And because I approach that way, and because I'm attentive to the world in that way, I can only make confusion worse confounded. But when I myself am nothing, reduced to my nothingness, as the Christian mystics say, functioning on the plane of no thing, as the Buddhist says, the samapatti, beyond akasha and vijnana, all this has tremendous significance, little understood. When I am in that state, then transcendence itself is working upon the world through this thing called me, the person. There is no me-ness, no I-ness, no self present here. This is the meaning of the no-self, one of the profound meanings. So misunderstood in the conventional presentation of the philosophy of anatta. Therefore, you see, when that is the case, the ill situation, I interact with the ill situation in a totally different way, an indescribably different way, from the way in which I interact as the worldling. It's very important to get the feel of this thing. By being what I am, everything happens. And now you will understand the true meaning of seeing, of listening, of hearing, of touching. In mind and consciousness, you are that which you see, which you hear. Bodily, of course, not. But in mind and consciousness, you are that which you see and touch and hear. And if selflessness has become the reality in you, seeing what we commonly call and legitimately call any one thing no longer remains for you. Seeing one thing. In a stone, in a dog, the sky, the carpet, a heap of manure, or anything whatsoever, in any one thing, in any one person, you will see not only that thing in its own rights, but you will see totality. This is the fact. The entire universe is there. One of the profound meanings, the esoteric meanings of Sri Krishna's statement to Arjuna, "Behold, O Arjuna, the whole universe seated in my body." You see, this is the power of transcendence. Don't translate transcendence as an other than myself or yourself or any one thing. This is the power of transcendence. The secret then, this attentiveness which glows at a white heat so that self-consciousness disappears. It is not suppressed. And your attentiveness is so complete and perfect not because some external object has so enraptured you that you are caught in a prison. You are trapped by it. Like a child's attention is absolute, when a child is absolutely captivated by the new toy that it receives, that is not paying attention. It is, its attention has been gobbled up by the toy. And when you pay attention like this, you are no longer paying attention to particular things, ideas, situations, feelings, emotions. You are just being totally attentive. If you direct your attention to a particular thing, you have confined yourself to the finite and the mortal and duality and conflict and all the rest of it. But if you are just attentive, awake. This is the meaning of the self-awakened one with regard when they speak of the full enlightenment, the sambodhi, and the complete self-awakening of the Buddha. This is its meaning. It is that state of such tremendous awakenedness that every single thing which sends its stimuli through the eyes, the ears, the skin, and so forth, is also simultaneously the totality. It's that kind of attentiveness. So you see, personal desire, personal objectives cannot come into the story. And when this white-hot attentiveness glows like that, then the complete purification is there. And our problem has vanished. There is only perfect action. The divine action, which is creative action in eternity. These are not just words, creative action in eternity.